to the Imprecise Storytelling Series, presented by Zooming in the Lens podcast with Olivia May, that's me, and my teacher, Katrina Chester. This series will be impromptu conversations that have arrived between Katrina and I. I've been in practice with her for a few years now, and we've also been blessed to share roles as employee and boss, friends, and most importantly, student to student. We offer these talks not to be right or wrong, not to be good or bad. Instead, to be present and amazed at how many ways to shift perceptions that lead to a deeper awareness of ourselves and others. I, for one, have been greatly affected by these kinds of conversations with Katrina, and I'm excited to share a day in the life of me at work, which is all practice. Imprecise storytelling is a metaphor. We all think we know who we are, and then we share who we are with those around us. But what if we are more or less? What if beliefs cloud what is? What if they stop the curiosity to explore? Just imagine if in doing that, we are our own imprecise storytellers. Hey, I'll take off my judgment hat if you take off yours.
Hey, it's Katrina from Zooming in the Lens podcast, and thanks for joining us. I have my friend Olivia here today. Say hi, Liv.
Hi, Katrina. Hello, everyone.
We're sitting here in the studio, and I had this interesting situation that occurred with a student, and I got permission for him to let me say the story, because I just found it really interesting. He, his name is Rich. This is the student. Mm-hmm. And Rich has a son that's like getting into like the teenage years. And he's been having difficulty lying, with lying. Like the son has been telling fabricated stories about very strange things too. Mm-hmm. Not anything that even makes him look good. Which is, I think, what made it interesting to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, parents struggle with this sort of stuff, especially when you get into being, you know, it's a teenage boy. And so it was bizarre stuff without getting into exactly what he was caught lying about. We were discussing lying for the last couple of weeks and them in their great attempts to try to say lying is not good. Why would you come up with this? Why would you do this? Went to speak to a therapist about it. And, you know, when you look under the DSM model of what lying is, I'm sure he got diagnosed with lots of like cool little 375, whatever the number is in the DSM. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I looked at it through this other lens as soon as the student for me became the teacher. And it was this really unique moment where he said to me, you know, I'm trying to get him to understand how important it is to tell the truth. Mm-hmm. But I also find that there's a part of me that is defining this as imprecise storytelling. Mm-hmm. And it just hit me in that moment. I sort of went, yeah, it's imprecise. I mean, it is. You can't say it's not. Mm-hmm. It's imprecise storytelling. And I said inconsistent storytelling. Mm-hmm. And as I drove away from that student, I thought, this isn't just this teenage boy's problem. It's like a grander scale human existence issue.
Well, it's the fact that we all live in our own reality. So who are we to say that he's actually not telling the truth in his reality?
Well, if you look at the facts, like think about being parents and having this kid tell a completely fabricated story. And the lie actually could have hurt him. Mm-hmm. Not the son, but the father. Mm-hmm. On one hand, yes, I agree. It's like, who are we to tell him that? But by the same token, as parents, I would think that what the job is to be a guide. Mm-hmm. Just however softly you can be. And with each kid, there's a different parent that shows up.
Yep.
I don't mean like mother or father. I mean a different person in you that mm-hmm. shows up for each kid, because you can't parent one child the same way you parent the other child. Any wise parents I've ever known has always taught me that.
Yeah.
So what was he getting from trying to teach his son just the linear fact of don't lie? Even going into like the therapeutic model of like, well, he's not feeling good about himself, and so that's why he's lying. But these lies weren't about him feeling good about himself. So they could have been signs that he wasn't feeling good about himself, because mm-hmm. they were things that wouldn't make him look very good.
Mm-hmm.
We'll never know. I mean, the child responded with, I don't know,
mm-hmm.
when he was asked,
yeah,
which is a common thing to say.
Yeah.
But I walked away from it with this imprecise storytelling title. And with the shift of my lens, just in a 20-minute drive to the next student, I saw it through the lens of our roles and our models, mm-hmm. like the things that we think we are.
Yep.
And it's not that we're not those things. It's just when you look at yourself as only those things, and then those things make you suffer because those things are supposed to look like A.
Mm-hmm.
They're supposed to end like B.
Mm-hmm.
And when and if they don't, we
suffer.
We suffer. So I just, like, in you and I discussing a topic that we wanted to share together on this podcast, and we were talking about discussing the roles and your roles in particular, which I'm really grateful that you're willing to come on here and talk about your roles, past, present, mm-hmm. whatever it ends up being, but how powerful those things are for us. And I hear this imprecise storytelling, and I feel like it immediately softens my judgment of somebody lying
mm-hmm.
or when we're lying. Like, can you feel that? Can you feel that if I say to a child or to a friend, you're a liar, or why are you lying?
Mm-hmm.
Why are you telling stories? Do you know it's not good to lie?
Yeah.
And I realize my inflections are different with that,
mm-hmm.
but I don't know a lot of people that calmly say those things. It just kind of comes with that territory. Versus when I say, in my own heart, I'm not saying you need to say this to the child or the person. It's imprecise storytelling. When I think of approaching like a nephew or a niece of mine, not telling them they're telling imprecise storytelling, but as I'm practicing to appear to them as somebody that's going to, you know, guide them, my own softening happens first. And when my own softening happens first in the role of disciplinary, which it does when I hear imprecise storytelling or inconsistent storytelling, I then approach that person or that child in a totally different way.
Mm-hmm.
And I started to see it through the lens of, we are all telling imprecise stories.
Yes.
About ourselves. It's not our fault.
No.
I think that it's, you know, exactly what yogic philosophy teaches. One of the main things is that you have to be curious. If you're not curious and you think you know what right and wrong is, you're not going to be open enough to hear it necessarily. So,
or hear anything new.
That's what I mean.
Yeah. Nothing new can come in.
No.
You're full.
You're full.
Mm-hmm.
You're full with the story of who you think you are and what right and wrong is. Is it right to lie? Let's just say that a self-practice of satya, which means truth, non-lying, is a great practice to notice yourself in lies that create violence. And sometimes it's a little harder to go right for the gusto. So if you go for where am I not telling the truth in things that aren't creating violence,
mm-hmm.
those are a little easier. Like, for example, if you tell somebody you're working when you're not working,
mm-hmm.
if you tell somebody, I don't have any money to go and do that with you, and you do, you just don't want to spend it on that.
Mm-hmm.
What I notice in those things are is that it's an internal conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You could write it, which I find very, very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
You can write down the noticings, right? And you're cultivating the witness and you're noticing where these nonviolent exaggerations or imprecise storytelling of self
mm-hmm.
and environment are taking place. And you're doing your own practice then with your own work. And so mm-hmm. it feels a little less scary because you're not calling yourself out on the lies that are the ones that are altering somebody else.
Yeah.
So maybe somebody wants to start with that. But a child doesn't have those moments unless an adult or a guide is practicing in those moments. Like, that's how they learn to do it, is by you. So even saying to somebody, I've defined lying now as imprecise storytelling, and you can see how when everybody lets go of the right and wrong of it, that the work for all of us is to just soften
mm-hmm.
the, like, how powerful it feels to, like, do a wrong and then do a right. And our moods reflect that of, like, this is the right thing to do, this is the wrong thing to do.
Yeah.
So I went back to this client and said, you know, we're all living imprecise storytellings of ourselves because we don't know anything past right now. We can have all these ideas of what we want to do with life and what our goals are. But when we cling to those things, we're shutting off that tap of what can be. And I find that when I shut that tap off, the stuff that my brain tells me it could be in line with suffering doesn't usually happen. It's like my mind is telling me this is going to be bad, this is going to be bad, this is going to be bad.
Worst case scenario going on.
Yeah. I mean, even this test that, you know, like there's this EMG I was supposed to take. And I had Ian call me up. He's the one, you guys will know him as the one who does the music and editing for this podcast. And unbeknownst to him, he didn't know that I had this test coming up, but he went and took this test. And ironically, or not so ironically, he calls me up and tells me I just had the worst test in the world. It hurt. It was the worst. It was like being electrocuted. And this is like a test that if you have numb hands or numb feet and you don't have diabetes, I don't know, maybe they give it to you if you do have diabetes, but it's not. They're trying to diagnose you here, and they hook up, they put needles in you and they shock you. And it's a 45-minute test to see if the reason why your hands are numb is maybe coming from a cervical neck injury. Is it nerve damage? So they're just like dissecting, you know, into what this could be. So he tells me how horrible this is, and I'm very silent on the phone. And I say, and he's not a guy to say this sort of stuff. That's the thing. You always got to look at where it's coming from. He's never really said anything like this to me before about a test. He's really strong, non-dramatic, exaggerating. He doesn't exaggerate at all. So, yeah, I'm going to take it really seriously. And I then said, well, that's the test I'm supposed to get.
So now you get a lot of story to sit with.
Wow.
About this test.
Wow, yeah. And I've, you know, of course, he tried to backstep. Well, maybe it's that I didn't eat.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's that I, you know, maybe my test was worse because...
Trying to help you get rid of your story.
Which is what we're all trying to do with each other, right?
Yeah.
That my imprecise storytelling... His that felt precise was precise for him. Yeah. But if all humans are alike, then his story
would be the truth.
It would be the truth for everybody.
Right.
But it's not, because there's many people that have that EMG and they don't feel that horrific, horrible test.
Yeah.
And it's all relative, right? Because if he's ever had a spinal tap,
mm-hmm.
then maybe he wouldn't think that was the worst test ever.
Right.
But we take these imprecise stories and they become right or wrong.
Yeah.
That's basically it in a nutshell, is that if we could look at that person's story and say, that's their story. But for me, that's an imprecise, or what did I say, inconsistent story, because it's not truth yet for me. But I couldn't do that.
Right.
So I went on a 2-week journey of avoiding having to book this test. And you know that it's on my schedule every day.
Mm-hmm.
Book EMG, book EMG, book EMG. And the stories are growing and growing and growing, and I'm scared. And this person tells me, oh, it wasn't that bad. And another person tells me, no, it really sucked. It was horrible. So then my mind is taking a poll on how many other people's stories are going to match Ian's story. Nothing to do with me, right?
No, you don't want to find out if it's actually real. You want to sit in the story.
Yeah, I don't, but my mind is.
Wants to, yes.
And yeah, where did that get me? A load of suffering, a lot of sleeplessness.
Mm-hmm.
And I go into the doctor 2 weeks later and he looks at me and says, so did you go do the EMG? And I really wanted to answer calmly and accurately.
Mm-hmm.
So I picked something that I've never done before in order to do that. And I calmly said, I'm noticing that I'm dealing with a bit of fear with this test. And I said it in that way because I didn't want to add so much fuel behind it, not just for myself, but for him.
Mm-hmm.
I guess in the past I would have said, I'm really scared. Like in my mind, mm-hmm. that feels like I'm being honest, but really what I'm doing is feeding to somebody how I want them to respond.
Yeah.
So I wanted to be as impartial as I could mm-hmm. in my shit, in my head. So I said that and he leans into me and he says, you don't really need to have that test. Oh my God. I both wanted to kill him
mm-hmm.
and I was so relieved.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I could feel that I understand that this is in me to have a fear for pain.
Mm.
And so I'm going to have to meet that.
Right.
Can I practice through it? Can I not practice through it? When does that become bullshit?
Mm-hmm.
When does it just become about laziness
mm-hmm.
or fear alone, even with no story? So, you know, I'm working with that. I'm working with that, and I'm not under any illusion that it's going to go away. I've gotten away with this one.
Mm-hmm.
But I am under no illusion that it is going to appear up here again.
Do you believe you don't need this test now? Like, you're totally happy with him having said that? You don't need it, and you're letting it go?
I am so happy, which is why I know that I can practice through this test. I could have.
Because you're not going to choose to now.
I'm not going to willingly bring suffering into me. I'm not evolved enough for that, right? At least with this. But yeah, I would probably say that I should do that.
It's really interesting how you were so happy to talk to so many people about their experience with this test.
Yeah.
And the minute one person tells you you don't need it, you're buying it.
Yes.
Like you're trusting in him. That one decision, like his thing you don't really
It's the
need.
One person that told me to get it.
Okay.
That's why I was, you know, if it was just a random person, I wouldn't listen.
Right. But we don't need like a second doctor's opinion.
I'm sure we do.
Okay.
But at the same time, I know I'm getting the MRI
mm-hmm.
of my neck mm-hmm. again.
Right.
And that creates a little bit of resistance in me.
Right.
So I'm going to try to direct it to that.
Mm-hmm.
And if they can't find what they're looking for through the MRI and I meet this entity called EMG again very soon, then I'm going to meet that
mm-hmm.
with kindness, knowing and remembering this moment of how much energy it took me to fight off this EMG, to fight off the stories of the EMG, mm-hmm. to take on the stories of everybody else's EMG. All inconsistent storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Not saying that Ian's wrong. That could have been right for Ian. But like, we're walking around with all these labels and titles and names.
Yep.
And when we aren't curious, even when we say to each other, I'm too busy.
Mm-hmm.
When we are strapped with those stories, nothing can grow from that. That's not fertile soil.
Yep.
It's, that's inconsistent storytelling in mm-hmm. itself. So I'm in a place in my practice now where, you know, I was given this title of, you know, inconsistent, imprecise storytelling. And I'm looking around at how many people that I know and love that have low self-esteem
mm-hmm.
or, you know, it's easier to see it in other people. And I use other people as a way to bring that into my own practice when I can't see clearly through to my own true story, you know?
Well, what you're seeing in other people is just a reflection of yourself.
Absolutely.
So you are seeing you.
I am seeing me. Yes, I am seeing me, and I'm seeing me as well when they're not believing in themselves.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And it's so believable
yeah.
to not believe in yourself.
Yeah.
Like, it's the most incredible movie. It's like a fact, you know? Somebody has a certain color hair, and you say they have, okay, say they have black hair. We look at that black hair title, mm-hmm. and it's permanent. It's mm-hmm. fixed. Now, I'm not saying they can't dye their hair and change the color, but while it's black, we can all agree that person has black hair. And then you realize that, like, feel in your mind how you never think about the color of that person's hair again.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's solved. The yeah. mystery is solved. But the mystery of life is never, ever solved. So there should be a really healthy dose in our life of taking on the unknowable.
Yeah.
Not from a goal-oriented place, because there can't be a goal, because there's too no much goal. Unanswered yeah. stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we can feel that propensity that the mind has, because that is the mind's job, is to solve things and get us from A to B and to survive in that reptilian part of our brain, to just keep going and keep going and solve and figure out, and what do we have? What do we do? And I'm not saying that we should at all be getting out of the model. I just think that there is simultaneously another place in which to investigate from and let that other model of the mind do its thing.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than that's the only view that we have of ourselves. And I believe so much in so many people that I work with and that I am friends with. And, you know, listen, at this point in my practice, even complete strangers that share with me, I can see so much in them and so much love that's available. And it feels so real that giving to somebody else, you know, we walk around and we feel like I need to give, I need to get, and we do. I'm not saying that we should stop that, but I just am imagining a world where we all sensed this imprecise storytelling of the self, and whatever we give outward, whether you volunteer or you do a kind act without attaching your name to it, nobody will ever know. And that equals, we then have to go home or go to a practice spot or go to a temple or an ashram or a church, whatever it is that calls you, and we have to match that. We have to match that in the internal kindness, the internal selfless giving.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not doing that. It's like a lot of us are just putting out.
Oh, yeah.
And not refueling?
Well, I think in a lot of ways we've been told that that's what's called selfish.
Right. That's right.
And I've definitely battled with that word because I've been called it a good portion of my life. But selfish is not have to be bad. It's about, I just meant I was really aware of myself constantly. Mm. And I think that's where a lot of the labels that I've took on, believed in, and am consistently shedding comes from. The selfishness of, I mean, I don't even know if it was, I thought I was really interesting and I just wanted to be all about myself.
And that's as harsh as the word lying. Like, yeah. I can call somebody selfish or I can say self-study.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
I can call somebody a liar or I can say imprecise storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
To who? You know, to who are you selfish? Yeah. It's more interesting who is saying that.
Yeah.
In them. And then absolutely. When we grab onto it, like you said, I can see myself in others because it's present in me.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of grabbing onto it and clinging to it, to use that as a way to investigate.
Yeah.
You know, what else is imprecise about us? What else are we believing that can we just softly... Could there be any space for it to be different? And I don't even like the word different. That feels like mm-hmm. very strong. Let's say in the softness of words, in the softness of the way we speak to ourselves internally, could you even conceive of a time and a place where what you're believing might not be true? That's it. That's all the practice is asking. Yeah. Is just, can you conceive of that?
Right. Possibly being wrong.
Possibly being wrong.
Is there any room for that inside?
Yeah, and let's not even say wrong. Let's say... imprecise.
Yes.
Inconsistent with the rest of the story.
Yeah.
It just, you know, meeting with that student and in that moment, you know, he, in many moments, he really taught me this beautiful way in which to look at roles and models in our life and illnesses and titles and even our names that bring all these thoughts to us of like, well, I know her because her name is Olivia and I remember her and that's how she'll stay in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized the power of just softening a little bit to say the word imprecise rather than lying to this teenage boy or just to the parents. Because I can see how I myself use imprecise storytelling as fact.
Mm-hmm.
And I can feel how limiting inside of me that is.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not speaking about anything that hasn't been spoken about for thousands and thousands yeah. of years. The Tao and... I just heard Alan Watts say something. Ah, what was it? Do I have it somewhere here? Yes, I do. We are driving a car by looking in the rearview mirror.
So good.
I mean, can you physically see that?
Moving forward, looking at the past.
If you drove a car and only looked in the rearview mirror, listen to the way I say that word, mirror.
Mirror.
Yeah, somebody made fun of me the other day. If that's all I did, I am absolutely going to meet with something harshly in front of me.
Yes.
And I can see myself in the car, physically in the car. I'm a visual person, so it helps me when mm-hmm. I'm in practice to actually see that when I'm dipping into the past of who I think I am, or I'm catapulting myself into the future of what could be. When I am not curious about the imprecise storytelling in that, that girl's hair is black and there's nothing else to think about it. And that's usually when I get responses from people that are like, well, who cares? It's just black hair. Who cares about even describing it? Because in some way, in large ways for me, I guess it depends on where you're at in life, but however positive I am about the blackness of her hair is how positive and how much I cling to models in myself and mm-hmm. roles within myself. So I'm not trying to enlighten this girl as to how black her hair is. It has nothing to do with her. I'm being the scientist and investigating myself through how much belief and weight I have put on the fact that I know she has black hair. Mm-hmm. And, you know, science has already discovered that what we're seeing is completely different in every person. And we're seeing so little of the story. We might as well be looking in the rearview mirror. We think we see something. And you can feel the mind say, that goes in this box. That goes, oh, she goes in this box. I look in the mirror and you see a face looking back at you and it doesn't look like the younger version that was in your head. There's suffering. So yoga really, you know, if you strip it down, is the process of being with what is.
Yeah.
You know, you and I started to talk about this in regards to the roles that we have in life,
mm-hmm.
the models. You know, roles are everything from being female to being a mom to being a dad to being a boyfriend, a daughter, a son,
mm-hmm.
an aunt, a friend. And in order for those roles to circulate and be living, breathing entities, there has to be a model that upholds that.
Mm-hmm.
And the model is, what is the belief that you carry of what it is to be a daughter or a boyfriend or any of those roles? What is the belief system that you work with? Like a good example is, let's say a man, okay? Say the role is man. And the model for that man in particular, this is not, of course, remember, we're dealing with inconsistent stories because everybody's individual. There are cultural beliefs. You want to bring those into it too. But the model for that man, what he was taught, and what he carries with him is that a man is supposed to be able to take care of his family, make great money, look a certain way, spend X amount of time with his children, drive this car, that car, be able to chase away bad guys in the middle of the night if your house is broken into.
Not cry.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think comedy is so funny from the Louis C.K.'s, you know,
mm-hmm.
who I think is awesome because he's bringing those things out. And if you're laughing at a comedian like that, or George Carlin, my favorite, if you Google George Carlin man, it's hysterical because he's talking about roles and models.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying exactly what the cultural belief is, what we were all brought up, you know, in this day and age, way longer than that, to believe that a man is responsible for. And then I heard this other comedian, I can't remember who it was, and I never laughed so hard in my life. He was talking about, he was letting the women in on the fact that, you know, listen, ladies, We are scared shitless. When you wake us up in the middle of the night and say, I heard a noise, go check it. He's like, I'm scared shitless. I don't want to get up. But now here I am stuck in this. He didn't use the word role model, but he said, here I am. If I don't get up, I'm a pussy.
Mm-hmm.
If I get up, I'm scared to death. What am I going to do when I meet this thing in the hallway or the door? He's like, I would like a woman to look over at me and be like, I hear a sound. I'm going to go check it out. And he goes, but even in that, I can't win because then I'm a jerk because I let my woman go check out. I mean, poor freaking
yeah
people, right?
Yeah.
Poor us.
Poor humans.
Yeah. I mean, there you may not feel like you're in touch with that belief system, but what I've come to realize through working with people, there's a level of that present in all of us. And when we report, no, I don't have that, I don't feel responsible, usually, not always, but usually they're busy fighting that.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll fight the model and they'll walk around saying, I want to fight a woman who's independent. I, you know, my prescription for women are women that want to pay for themselves. And so then you're just going the other way. You know that saying that I love, blanking for virginity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you could fill it in. But we end up on the other side, like I am with the EMG, pushing it away.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of juice, as much juice in that as taking on the model and knowing about it. So I think the first thing, you know, in discovering the role and model is to really investigate what are the roles
yeah.
in your life. And then to write down just the facts of like where, what is your belief system? Even if it's not something you agree with, which a lot is yeah. for me, I'll write down a belief system and I'll at the same time be going, but I don't believe this at all.
Yeah.
But it's really important to just keep going, because you're getting to the ending, and the ending is that it doesn't serve you, and you're sensing that. There's a part of you that senses that it doesn't serve you because you're really not feeling aligned with it.
Yep.
But yet, if we look at what has transpired in your past or your current, it may be that you actually, the inconsistency is in the fact that you, that is becoming more important than you aligning with the fact that it's not who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Is that making sense?
Yeah.
Did I just confuse the shit out of it? I might have.
No, it was just getting me on thinking about, you know, your work and what you do and how you're sort of teaching everyone a little bit of one of the projects you give your clients. You know, it obviously roles, models, reactions.
Yes.
And
right.
It made me sort of like, as I'm listening to you, my head's going in its own story where I'm like, I start to like look at the actual page of what my roles, models, and reactions looks like. And I've sort of only done it in my head. I've never really written it down like you've told me time and time again to
well,
do.
Really? Okay then.
And I'm like,
you are an inconsistent storyteller. No, I'm kidding.
Just wondering if
it helps
showing an example of us, like almost if we were to do that out loud right now.
Yeah.
With mine.
Let's do it.
What it would look like.
I would love that.
So one of my roles is I'm a daughter. But and I've realized I'm two daughters. I'm a daughter to my mom, and then I'm a daughter to my dad. Completely different daughters.
Interesting.
And so I guess those are the two roles. And then the model of what daughter to my mom is, would the model be telling her everything? Complete.
Yeah, I love to put the words in, a good daughter tells her mom everything.
A good daughter
yeah.
tells her mom everything. And I think I've definitely done a good portion of that for sure.
If you feel like a good daughter is the model, because there's some people out there that look at the word daughter and they say they might be living in that a daughter is somebody that gives their mom space.
Mm-hmm.
And a good daughter is somebody that visits once a year. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, yeah. That might be the great daughter for us, but if
that's
you ask,
all the good daughter I can think.
Yeah. If you ask your mom, that might not be a great daughter. So really, it's not about what's right or wrong. It's about when you hear the word daughter, what are the assumptions
mm-hmm.
of what a daughter is? What do you believe? What were you taught? What's in there?
I feel like I have less of an opinion about being a good daughter to my mom, what that means, because I just we have a great relationship. I feel good. We communicate when we communicate. And there's no tug of war with you're bad, you're good, like anything. It's more of I don't know what kind of daughter I am to my dad, only that I feel most of my life is that I've been a bad daughter to my dad.
Isn't it interesting? So you're saying good daughter, you're a good daughter with your mom because there's no problems. You're a bad daughter with your father because there's problems, whether they're his or yours. Correct. Is left to be undetermined. In order to make your father, your role as daughter to your father, bad, what the mind tends to do is make the relationship with your mother good.
Right.
Right? So we see the duality right there in the present of that. And if you... Is your belief system, should a daughter have a good relationship with their mother? Is that a belief that exists?
I don't know that I believe it. I just am fortunate to feel that I have one.
Mm-hmm. What if you didn't?
Well, in a way, I mean, I understand what having no daughter relationship, not with a mother, but I have the experience of some years of having no relationship with my father. So I know what it's like to have no relationship too.
Mm-hmm. And the suffering comes with the choice of words.
Mm-hmm.
So if the relationship with your father is the daughter role of being daughter to that father is bad, that you can feel, I mean, just tell me if you can't, but can you feel how that feels like somebody's fault and how that feels like a suffering that is either I have to forget about it or what else haven't I tried?
Okay.
Like it's calling for an action of some sort, either action or inaction.
Right.
Inaction of like, I don't care, but that's an action.
Yeah.
I don't care. If you don't care, there would be no good or bad label needed.
Right.
So it's showing us that.
Right.
That when we make something bad or good, there's a lack of equanimity in it for it to be actually what it might be.
Mm-hmm.
We can't reveal its truth. And if you're not supposed to have a relationship with your father, which nobody knows that,
right.
That's just, again, that's the part of the mystery.
Mm-hmm.
What is it like to investigate the bad from that place, not from I'm bad, but what do I consider a bad relationship with a dad? What do I consider a bad daughter to a dad? Because we're trying to keep it in our stuff, not dipping into, well, it's because he does this, he does this.
Right.
So if you look at your mom's situation, might you be able to soften that it's great, we have communication, and I don't have any problem with it? I'm sure at some points in your life you have, because you've once been a teenage girl.
Yep.
And I don't know a lot that don't.
So
you can relate to it from that well.
Yeah.
That at one point, at certain points in life, the relationship with of being a daughter to a mother can be rocky, but you came out of that.
Yeah.
And you could go back in.
Yep.
You don't know. So it's really more about being okay with the unknown than it is about trying to get your dad, and the daughter of a dad, to be good.
Yeah.
So I guess you would say that it's finding equanimity. With the word equanimity, for me, the easiest way for me to look at it is a balance.
Yeah.
It's when we're not clinging. And if we cling to my relationship is fine with my mother, so I'm not going to work on it. That's equivalent to that girl has black hair. Who cares? It doesn't need work.
No curiosity.
That's right.
Yeah.
So as we look at the two models, which, you know, is great that you brought up the both of them, we want to see how we can wake up in that role. Not to shed the role. If it sheds, it sheds. Great. Yeah. Or not. Okay. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know your life or even mine.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really interesting because it tends to be in the word spirituality, it tends to fall in line with that power of positive thinking. And people go, well, why would I want to take a perfectly good relationship with my mother and look at it bad? That's not what we're saying.
No.
But just feel how when we think something's going great, how there's almost this complacency, this lack of curiosity. When we feel like something's bad, it immediately feels like a responsibility, a weight. It tends to feel like the word fix or we give up. That feeling of like helplessness comes a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I'm making clear that it's not to try to get anywhere. And I wish it were as easy as saying, let's pick out all the relationships that you feel suck and are bad,
mm-hmm.
and let's work on those. Mm-hmm. I haven't been able to do that unless I also look at the good.
Mm-hmm.
Because I need to know how the mind is determining good.
Yeah.
And you and I both know that when we're in relationships with anybody, a large reason why relationships go south, perhaps in love relationships or in any relationship, is when there's complacency. When there's that lack of cultivation, when there's that, I know who you are, so I'll just...
So the figuring out got done.
Yes. Which is why that honeymoon period in love relationships is so all-encompassing for us. It's like you can't find your keys, you're not eating, you're higher than a kite.
Mm-hmm.
And
you think that's what love really is, and when that goes away... You must not be in love anymore.
And you know what? I'll even go so far as to say I do believe that love does feel like that. It's just that when it's love, when it's your truth in love and you're practicing shedding from the mind's love to maybe like a more of a heart love, that... To me, I describe that kind of honeymoon period love as like a spiritual joy.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't leave. And it doesn't make you as loopy, like as... I don't, in the moments that I've been able to have it, it doesn't make me as absent-minded. It's just... those same things that would worry me, the relationship changes mm-hmm. to them. So in going over that, do you resonate with that? Once something's good, like your mom and you's relationship, your mom and you's. You's guys. Can't take the girl out of New York. or can't take New York out of the girl. Can you just imagine a space where you get curious as to who else in your mother there might be?
Oh, I'm experiencing that. I'm experiencing that a lot. I'm with my mother, I'm experiencing just how interesting it is to see her grow. And I look less of her as a mother to me. She's my mom. It's more like, look at this amazing human being that's
What a great shift.
Living in 2016 right now.
Not spiting the fact that she's your mother.
Right. It's
it's not one for the other.
And I definitely had, at a very young age, the memory of sort of a light going off where, oh my goodness, my parents had lives before me.
Far out stuff. And yeah.
I told her that probably in like 8th or 9th grade, 10th grade. I was like, you know, Mom, I know that you have a life that existed before me. And I thought this was the most amazing thing I could ever tell my mom. My mom was pissed. I think she thought I meant that, like, kind of in the tone of, well, I guess you just have a life other than me, Mom. I think she took it. I don't think I had that tone. But you know what that tone kind of means? Almost like, ugh, like yeah. Some sort of sarcasm to it.
That teenage snot.
Where I must have sounded like a snot. But I thought I was just giving her like the most like magnificent moment I've just experienced. That like I broke out of this mold of thinking the world's all about me. That's how I felt. Yeah. I thought I was having a huge moment. And I obviously was, because it's still a memory I have etched in my brain. But I remember her sort of being like, what did you just say?
So she missed that opportunity then.
Yeah, and that's because it was whoever she was then. She must have felt she was obviously showing me she wanted to have life outside of being a mom, maybe. That's what I can take from it right now. And maybe she felt guilty about that.
Mm.
That she would want to have a life, you know, like that wasn't being a parent. And that's just speculation, but I remember that being such a big moment, and I felt like I knew I was pretty young to be having it. So I'm experiencing my mom now, and I have for a while, just, this is a beautiful human, you know, I love her, I know I love her, and I'm excited to experience her life. I'm experiencing more of that with my father now, and that's probably a bigger shift, because there was times that I chose to have no relationship. Push the relationship away. We butt heads too much. We're too similar. And I like seeing the attachment to bad daughter that I've had with my dad soften, subside, realize, you know, give myself the ability to have been angry when I was angry. It was truthful to who I was then. But I don't have to believe that anger anymore. I don't have to be angry about past things. And I'm lucky that my dad doesn't throw the time I was away from him in a relationship in my face all the time. You know what I mean? Like, he's never, it's sort of, he's just welcomed the fact that I'm back in the capacity that I am. And here I am, the one grieving, feeling sad about who I was when I needed space. And no one's giving me shit about it. Sorry if I was not supposed to say that.
No, you can tell
yourself. But, it's just been a really interesting witness time for myself of how much I feel like I deserve to be reprimanded. You know, reminded that I chose to not be around. Reminded that I let a relationship go. Mm-hmm. Like, and no one in my family is doing it. But in my head, I'm sort of just waiting for them to do it because they feel like they have the right to. But no one is. I'm just doing it to myself.
Doesn't it sometimes feel like the only way to get shit done is to put ourselves down?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I don't put myself down, how am I going to change?
Uh-huh.
If I'm too nice to myself, if I'm too kind and forgiving, it's just going to keep happening. I'm just going to keep taking advantage of people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an imprecise story. And we're the teller of that.
Oh, it's, you know, I'm witnessing a little bit of that in my love relationship. Where he's like, you're too nice to me. I need to be working out. I'm like, so, okay, we're happy. I think you look great. When I say I feel like I need to work out more, you tell me you look great.
Yeah.
You don't need to work out anymore. was like, you tell yourself a lot of things about yourself, and I'm not going to buy into that. I think you look great, but I want you to be happy with yourself. So go do those things that make you feel good. Is that working out 5 times a week? Because I don't know if you sitting obsessing about it, like, he wants me to match him almost.
Of course, yeah. Well, that's all we're doing, right?
Hey, I'm a bad person, aren't I? Tell me how bad.
We're always looking for somebody to motivate us, you know? And we feel like if you're in a relationship and somebody is not happy with the way you look, it's almost going to motivate you to do something about it.
Yeah.
And really, yes, you can keep going down that, like, it's like the carrot and the horse, and just keep following that and looking for that. But what it's really asking us to do is to just use this as an opportunity. It's not saying don't take action, but is there an opportunity there for us to look at the situation and think, how am I not finding okayness, I'll say,
mm-hmm.
in maybe not looking like I did when I was 20.
Mm-hmm.
But if we keep making it about, I need the motivation, I need the discipline, I need the this, all of those things are perceived to be coming from outside sources. And it's very ambiguous to say, it comes from inside, it comes from inside. And I realize that. And I don't even think I'm saying that. It'll come from where it comes from. But the invitation is to, when we, in his scenario that you're giving me,
mm-hmm.
is so perfect, because how many people haven't felt like him? I mean, I have completely felt like that. It's that moment to say, wow, so I can feel within myself that if I let go too much, and don't stay on this disciplined trail of the gym, this and this, that I'm going to start to look bad.
Mm-hmm.
And how much easier it is to have somebody threatening me that they're going to leave, or they're not wanting to have sex as much, and that's an indication.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to suffer with that system, and we're going to also suffer if that system has nothing to do with it and that person breaks up with you anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the person can leave you whether you're fit or not. So what's the fear? What's the surrender part inside of our own hearts? What is it saying is the eventuality? What's the story? That you're going to be fat and ugly? Is that... you'll never be able to do it again. They'll leave you. Everybody's always showing up. All of us. I always show up, and it's so easy to figure me out. Always. We're always telling each other where we're at.
Yeah.
We're just so narcissistic that most of the time when we're talking to somebody and somebody's talking to us, we're either preparing what we're going to say to them, or we're relating it to ourselves. That's not listening.
Yeah.
That's not holding space. It's just that an untrained mind, that's what its job is. I can't not love the mind for what it's doing.
Yeah.
So it's asking him to pause. And simultaneously, while his mind is saying, yeah, I should do that, and you don't, or, yeah, I know, but the point is this, and, you know, that we have all these stories we say back to somebody when they say that to us. Just pause, and in that space, do something different,
mm-hmm.
whether it's writing down just, you know, stream of consciousness thoughts of, like, let's talk about the absolute worst thing that's going to happen because Olivia is not telling you that if you get out of shape, she's not going to love you anymore. Like, you realize what people are wanting each other to do to each other.
Yeah.
We're all victim of that. We feel like we need that.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that we don't. What I'm saying is that it's interesting to slow down and find the personal responsibility in that, because you're either going to do it or not do it. You're going to do it awake or asleep, you know, spiritually. And this journey isn't about being perfect. It's not about saying, well, now I don't expect anything from anybody. I mean, good luck with that if that's what you think spirituality is. It's about showing up with what is, and what is in you. And it's not you, but it's in you. So, like, we feel like everything is happening to us. And so then it becomes like we become victims of our own circumstances. But if you can just soften and use the word, these are things happening. They're not things that are happening to us. They're things that are happening. Why? Because they're facts. What's a fact? Whatever's happening. Mm-hmm. Whatever's happening. The wise don't sit around figuring out what could be happening in 5 minutes or in an hour or in 3 hours. And I feel like many times I just don't trust my mind enough to know that my mind is always cataloging what's safe and what's not from a survival standpoint. And my mind has cataloged when it's safe to cross the street and when it's not. I don't need to consciously tell my mind, wait for the cars to stop. That sort of faith is what it takes for us to, in that pause, understand that we don't need the mind for everything. And when the mind gets involved in love, romantic love relationships, and our inner dialogue, it means that there's a model that we're striving after. So I guess in essence, Olivia, anytime we say my relationship is good, you're pretty much forecasting suffering.
Yeah.
But the problem is that we don't communicate like people. Like, not the problem. A problem is that we don't communicate as friends, as relatives. We're not asking each other the right questions. We're asking each other, how are you? Mm-hmm. Are you happy?
Yep. And we all have specific answers we're supposed to say back.
That's right.
And when it's different from that, it's uncomfortable. People don't want to continue.
That's right. That's right. So notice, for me, I noticed when I would get good news, I would call certain people. When I got bad news, I would call other people.
Yeah.
I just found it interesting. I just noticed it.
Yeah.
Notice that I'm not sitting here saying, bad Katrina, bad mind, bad thoughts, good thoughts. I'm not really interested in that because the mind's doing that all by itself. It's been programmed already. What I'm trying to do is not get more. I'm actually trying to shed. I'm not trying anything. I am fully aware that too much participation from me is not good. Because when I am setting out to get enlightened, I'm so far away from it that I couldn't even spit and touch it.
Music and editing. Special thank you to Ian Hatton. If you'd like more information on Ian, go to mixforpix.com.